From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 8th day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk with the folks at L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, about the agricultural futures markets. At the bottom of this half hour, we'll discuss the agricultural weather forecast with Don Day of Day Weather. And in between, we'll update the state statisticians' numbers in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota. Those are the top five corn-producing states in the nation, and talk with Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services about the agricultural energy markets. In the second half hour of the program today, we'll continue a conversation we started a couple of weeks ago but didn't quite finish with Colleen Callahan. She's the state director in Illinois for USDA Rural Development. And we'll hear again from Carl Bradley about foliar fungicides in corn. It all happens on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby July wheat at $4.32 and a quarter, a settlement price unchanged. September at $4.49, down a quarter. And December at $4.79 and a half, a half cent lower. July Kansas City hard red at $4.62, unchanged on the afternoon. July corn futures, $3.37 and a quarter, a penny and a half higher. September at $3.46, up 1 cent. December at $3.56 and a half, up a penny and a half. And the March corn at $3.69 and three quarters, up a penny. The May futures of next year at $3.79, up 1 cent for the afternoon. July soybean futures at $9.31, down 4 cents. August at $9.12 and a quarter, 5 and a half lower. September at $8.98 and a quarter, down 6. And November soybean futures $8.94 and a quarter, down 5 and three quarters. January contract at $9.03 and a quarter, down 7 and a quarter. July bean meal futures $2.76.80, down $1.90. July soybean oil at $36.67, 20 cents higher on the afternoon. June live cattle futures $89.95, up 15. The August at $87.82 and a half, a dime higher. August feeders at $108.85, 45 cents higher. And the September feeder cattle, $108.65, 37 and a half cents higher. June lean hog futures at $77.62 and a half, finished this Tuesday afternoon down 15 cents, but the July were 17 and a half higher at $78.20, a hundredweight higher. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, July contracts, $71.82 a barrel, up 38 cents. July ethanol at $1.55 and 9 cents, a tenth of a cent higher. Natural gas at $4.79 and 9 cents, down 11 and 7 tenths. And the heating oil at $1.95 and 8 cents. That's diesel fuel, down 9 tenths of a cent. Gold futures at $1,244 even, settlement price up $4.70, and the Dow now 47 points higher at 98.63. The U.S. dollar at 88.4 is 0.002 higher on the afternoon, and the CRB index at 250.08 is 1.1 higher. The Goldman Sachs at 477.77 is 2.61 higher for the day. Here's what the weather forecast says for the Midwest. Soft wheat quality, a little disease issue, should continue over the coming week. That, of course, due to wet field conditions and some additional rain, although drier and warmer weather will be needed, of course, to make that harvestable in the very near future. Two more significant waves of rain will push through the Midwest between now and Sunday, each to produce widespread rainfall and maintain wet field conditions. Late season planting and spraying delays will continue. Drier weather, though, will come likely next week. There is no blocking high pressure ridge anticipated through at least the next 10 days and perhaps longer. Temperatures should be seasonable, bouncing from slightly below normal to slightly above normal and back again. Established crops should continue to develop favorably in this environment. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour here on the Closing Market Report and talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
On this Tuesday afternoon, you're listening to the Closing Market Report. Time to check the agricultural futures markets. John Hester of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, is with us. Wayne Nelson is away from the office this afternoon. Thanks for filling in, John.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again, Todd.
You get to fill in on a good day or a bad day, as you might see it. November beans below $9. That's the first time that's happened in a very long time. What can you tell me about it?
Well, $9 had been support for quite a while, and the crop ratings came out yesterday, and the crop was rated at 75% good to excellent, which was a little better than expected, and they're expecting, maybe 78 million acres will get planted to soybeans, and that may be a little higher than expected, and I hate to say it, probably beans should be below $9 with them kind of numbers and the potential for a crop that we have, barring a weather scare.
As you look at what the Iowa statisticians have been saying, and we'll hear this from him just a bit later, the southeastern part of that state, and I would think maybe the southern part of the state, has had much rougher time. I would think that would be more bean country than corn country, although it's a pretty even swap. But I would think the further north you go, the more likely it is that they're doing corn on corn. Do you think that we will eventually see, because of the rough weather, maybe abandoned acres? I have my doubts on that one, but at least a lower bean yield figure coming out of the United States?
Well, as of right now, I don't know how you can say that because, last year the beans weren't planted at this time and we still had tremendous bean crop across the nation. And, I think if we can get the beans planted in the next week to 10 days, finish the crop, they say, about 80% of the beans are planted. I don't remember the number, but, if they can get them planted, hopefully in a timely fashion in the next 10 days, and the weather's correct, we could still have a huge bean crop.
Anything else that you've been watching and talking to producers about on the phone today?
Oh, not necessarily talking to producers, but there was a lot of bean spreading going long July, short November beans. There was about 5,000 spreads done in the last 15 minutes, and that's kind of what sold the bean market off. And also Congress is talking about the biodiesel blend rebate that they're going to give the producers. So I don't know where they're going to pass it, but they're going to talk about it again. So that's good things that could happen. But, I think a lot of it was also evening up a little bit going into this report Thursday. And I guess my hunch is that maybe beans will be up a little bit tomorrow on positioning before the report.
And when they go long and along the nearby and short the deferred, that's pretty good sign that there's a bull market to be built, at least in the short term, right?
Short term, nearby months, yes. I think there is, I don't know how large the shortage is, but I think there is a small shortage of old crop beans, or the processors need beans to crush, and the farmers are holding tight. And, around here the basis is 5 to 15 over on beans, and I'm sure at other places it's a lot better than that. So, the processors are wanting old beans, and that's the reason they would bull spread it.
John, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, nice talking to you.
Good to talk
Bye.
To you, too. John Hester is with L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Nationally, 94% of the 2010 corn crop had emerged by June the 6th, reported USDA yesterday. That's 9 percentage points ahead of last year, 3 points ahead of the 5-year average. Emergence most rapid in Colorado, where warm temperatures provided ideal growing conditions during the week. Overall, 76% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's unchanged from the ratings last week, but 7 percentage points better than this same time last year. By the week's end, soybean producers had planted 84% of this year's crop, 8 percentage points ahead of last year, but on par with the 5-year average. Severe weather conditions, including scattered rain, hail, some strong winds in Iowa, that's the largest soybean-producing state, limited planting progress there to just 4 percentage points during the week. Nationally, mostly ideal growing conditions throughout much of the major soybean-producing region promoted emergence of 20 percentage points during the week. At 66% complete, progress was 14 percentage points ahead of last year and slightly ahead of the 5-year average. Overall, 75% of the soybean crop said to be in good to excellent condition. Now here are the state statisticians.
This is Brad Parks, Deputy Director from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Iowa Field Office, with a weekly crops and weather report for the week ending June 6, 2010. Iowa received another round of scattered rain, wind, and hail. Precipitation amounts were variable throughout the state. Northern Iowa received less rain than southern Iowa, where reports of up to 7 inches were received. Localities hit with large amounts of rain reported standing water and erosion, while western Iowa reported hail and high winds that caused minor crop damage. Drier areas of the state, like northwest Iowa, benefited from the wet week, while southern Iowa was forced to battle saturated conditions again. Reports indicated this planting season has been worse than 08 and 09 for producers in a few counties in southeast Iowa. Ample precipitation and warm weather aided rapid corn growth and late-planted soybean emergence. As corn near row closure, operators are concerned about completing their spraying before it gets too tall. Almost all the expected corn acreage has emerged, and its condition rated 1% very poor, 4% poor, 17% fair, 55% good, and 23% excellent. Soybean acreage planted increased to 95%, similar to last year and the 5-year average of 94%. Soybeans emerged reached 82%, 5 percentage points ahead of last year and 6 percentage points ahead of the 5-year average. Soybean condition rated 1% very poor, 4% poor, 20% fair, 55% good, and 20% excellent. Again, this has been Brad Parks, Deputy Director from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending June 6, 2010.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending June 6th. Above normal temperatures and rainfall blanketed most of the state last week, with some localized thunderstorms producing strong winds and hail. However, most farmers were able to finish replanting corn, and soybean planting advanced even though there was only an average of 3.2 days suitable for field work. Statewide corn emergence advanced to 97% compared to 70% emerged last year and 90% for the 5-year average. The average height of emerged corn now stands at 17 inches, compared with 7 inches last year and 12 inches for the 5-year average. Overall, the corn crop was rated in 73% good or excellent condition. Soybean planting advanced to 82% complete, compared to 55% planted last year and 81% for the 5-year average. 69% of soybeans have emerged, compared to 21% a year ago and 63% for the 5-year average. Overall, the soybean crop was rated in 65% good or excellent condition. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 82% of the heads filled, compared with 76% 1 year ago and 81% for the 5-year average. 46% of fields were reported turning yellow, compared to 34% last year and 49% for the 5-year average. The condition of the wheat crop was rated 7% very poor, 11% poor, 42% fair, 36% good, and only 4% excellent. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Scott Keller with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office, with a weather and crops report for the week ending June 6, 2010. Warm temperatures and widespread rainfall supported crop development during the week. However, the rainfall did delay planting of the last fields of soybeans and sorghum, and it challenged hay producers with hay on the ground. Hail was recorded in a number of areas. However, overall, winds did quiet down during the week, allowing herbicide applications. Statewide corn condition rated mostly good to excellent, with 96% of the crop emerged. Soybean planting was 94% complete. Sorghum planting 68% finished, and dryable bean planting was 67% done. Wheat conditions rated mostly good to excellent, with 70% of the crop headed. Wheat diseases continue to be a concern in some areas. Oats condition rated mostly good to excellent, and the first cutting of alfalfa was 60% done. This is Scott Keller with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, the Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending June 6, 2010. Crop condition ratings held steady despite cooler temperatures and scattered precipitation. Temperatures returned to the seasonal averages after nearly 2 weeks of above-normal temperatures. Repeated light rains prevailed during the week, with the south-central and southeast regions of the state receiving over 1.3 inches on average. There were reports of isolated hail. Corn was 98% emerged with an average height of 8 inches. Soybeans were 98% planted with 83% emerged and an average height of 3 inches. Corn condition was rated 92% good to excellent, unchanged from the previous week. And soybean condition was rated 83% good to excellent, up 1 percentage point from the previous week. 59% of the spring wheat and 60% of the barley were jointing, with 2 and 8% heading, respectively. 71% of oats was jointing, and 11% was heading. All three crops were rated with at least 90% good to excellent condition. That's the weekly crop weather report for the week ending June 6, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana. And this is the crop weather report for the week ending June 6th. Thunderstorms across the state restricted field work for the week, bringing a slow, prolonged finish to the corn planting season. The wet fields and humid conditions slowed soybean planting and limited hay production. Winter wheat is nearing full maturity, and harvest activity is expected soon in southern Indiana. 97% of the intended corn acreage has been planted, ahead of last year's 88% and 95% for the five-year average. 92% of the planted corn acreage has emerged, ahead of the 69% recorded for last year and the 86% for the five-year average. Corn condition for the week was rated at 70% good to excellent, compared with 64% for last year at this time. 81% of the intended soybean acreage has been planted, compared with 66% for last year and 81% for the five-year average. 69% of the planted soybean acreage has emerged, ahead of the 39% recorded for last year and the 63% for the five-year average. Soybean condition for the week was rated at 67% good to excellent, compared to 65% for last year at this time. 97% of the winter wheat acreage is headed, compared with 96% for last year and 97% for the five-year average. Winter wheat condition is rated at 70% good to excellent, compared to 76% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Urbana-Champaign. We'll talk with Stephen Platt in just a moment. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural energy market. Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services in Chicago joins us. It's an ADM affiliate. Good afternoon to you, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about the marketplace from your perspective.
Well, right now we are seeing some modest support, but overall the market's been showing some weakness off of demand concerns linked to both Europe and even China. The overall situation still points to a rather ample stock situation with forward coverage pretty much at some of its highest levels it's been for quite some time. The market's also looking ahead to some pretty key reports coming out of Europe tomorrow in terms of their stock situation, and also the International Energy Agency's report, which will also be happening here in a couple of days.
For clarification, we're talking about crude oil stocks, right?
Crude oil and also the prevailing trends in both demand and supply.
Yeah, so we have a $71.72 price on the July crude oil at this point. Will it go lower?
Well, I think there's that possibility. What we are seeing, I think, is the market actually reflecting some of the base fundamentals. We're still certainly vulnerable to some liquidation pressure coming maybe from some of the investment funds, which still appear to be somewhat long through some of these ETFs.
Is crude what's the impact of a higher dollar on the price of crude? So,
well, it certainly lowers the pressure by OPEC to try to raise prices. I think that's one factor, but also given that oil is priced in dollars, it does have somewhat of a demand impact overseas as well.
Yeah, so it makes, let me think about this, it makes crude oil less affordable overseas, which would put a cap on demand, I suppose. And then in the same process, it's easier for the United States to purchase crude oil, so the price would still be pushed down. Do I get both of those right?
That would be right, but in a lot of ways, oil demand can be pretty inelastic in terms of response to price. We have seen it at the extremes, certainly being impacted. But, you know, right now I think people are pretty comfortable with where prices are. Certainly everyone wants them to come down, but certainly they're not moving sharply higher either.
Have you been paying much attention to the ethanol industry and margins there?
Well, the margins have actually improved here, and I think there's certainly some prospect that, you know, the increase in the blending requirement could certainly help and come about finally maybe to that 12% area in terms of adding ethanol to gasoline to that 12% range. And that has certainly helped the spread, which has benefited moving from as much as 80 cents in terms of gasoline over back into around 43. And I think there's still some potential there in terms of the ethanol gaining on gasoline here as we move into the summer.
Do we think that U.S. EPA will make that decision anytime soon?
Well, there's some talk that it could come within a couple months. And I think they've had enough time to really assess the impact, which they have been concerned about in terms of some of the older cars.
Stephen, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Stephen Platt is with Archer Financial Services. It's an ADM affiliate located in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us once a month on Tuesdays. We always take a look at the agricultural energies on Tuesday afternoons here on the Closing Market Report. Stay with us in just 2 minutes. We'll return and talk with Don Day about the agricultural weather forecast.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. The Federal Reserve says that U.S. consumer credit rose modestly in April but remained depressed as Americans declined from taking on new debt amid high unemployment. Total outstanding credit to U.S. consumers, everything from car loans to credit card accounts, rose by $955 million during April to $2.44 trillion. Only the second rise in the last 15 months. Non-revolving credit jumped $9.41 billion, while revolving accounts fell $8.46 billion. The chief executive of the CME Group today says that last month's dramatic plunge in U.S. share prices was probably due to stock market fragmentation and not to high-speed trading. The May 6th flash crash rattled investors globally and exposed deep flaws in the high-speed U.S. marketplace. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged some 700 points in minutes before sharply rebounding that afternoon. Sales are still climbing at McDonald's. The company today says that May sales in locations open at least a year rose 4.8% around the globe. In the U.S., the figure is up 3.4%. Sales climbed 5.7% in Europe and 3.8% in other regions. CEO Jim Skinner says U.S. sales are being driven by the company's new icy drinks, chicken nuggets, and kids' meals. And the Energy Information Service today says that U.S. retail gasoline prices were virtually unchanged last week. U.S. regular unleaded gas remained at $2.73 a gallon, dropping 0.3 cents from a week earlier. And that's a look at today's business news.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon, Don Day of Day Weather. Out of Cheyenne, Wyoming joins us to take us through a rocky 24-hour period and beyond. Tell me about the weather here in the Midwest to begin with.
Well, we have certainly seen an uptick in the severe weather, obviously, with all the nastiness that rolled through over the weekend. And we see other small weather systems, typical for early June, coming in out of the western high plains, the northern plain states, and migrating east across the Midwest. And this is going to trigger occasional periods of showers, thunderstorms, and we're going to have to contend with some severe weather at times as well.
And how much rainfall will we get with them and how widely spread? Usually those are dumpers in some areas and nothing in others.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you should expect. I think that the heaviest precipitation is going to come with this first wave, and that's going to be moving through as we work our way into tonight and into the morning hours of Wednesday. It really looks like overnight tonight and Wednesday morning, northern Illinois, northern Ohio, Indiana, portions of Missouri, and southeastern sections of Iowa, as well as southern Wisconsin, likely going to see the heaviest rain. And there's going to be some 1-, 2-, 3-inch rains in those areas. There will also be half-inch to inch rains across central and southern Illinois into southern Indiana falling late tonight through tomorrow morning. The coverage should be pretty good, but I think it'll be those areas to the north that have the bulk of the rain.
And when will it blow out? Is that finished up tomorrow, and is there another system behind it right away, or do we clear out for a while?
Well, I think we will clear out late tomorrow and through, let's say, most of Thursday. Now, as we get into late Thursday night and Friday, especially Friday and into the weekend, do expect another batch of showers and thunderstorms to move in. And that'll be followed by what will probably be more shower and thunderstorm activity by the middle to the end of the week. So there is definitely an uptick in not only the frequency of precipitation chances, but amounts as well. And folks do need to be prepared for several bouts of severe weather with this pattern.
Yeah, is the weekend weather most likely to go through the northern parts of Illinois and the upper Midwest, or what kind of track might it follow?
Well, at first, it's going to affect the western areas. The western areas will feel the effects of this shower and thunderstorm pattern this weekend in Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, into the eastern Dakotas. But as we get into Saturday night late into Sunday morning, Sunday is the day where shower and thunderstorm activity will pick up across the Midwest.
And check in on China very quickly, please.
China, looking at a pattern very similar to ours. Temperatures are beginning to get a little bit warmer, especially in some of the central and eastern areas. Frequent chances for thunderstorm and rain activity in China as well.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Tuesday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. If not, you can always pick it up at willag.org. That's willag.org. Today we'll continue our conversation we had about a week or so ago with Colleen Callahan. She is the State Director in Illinois for USDA Rural Development. I'm Todd Gleason.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
Just a quick reminder before we get into the farming world to have you visit willag.org. That's willag.org. USDA will release its latest WASDE figures on Thursday morning of this week. And if you'd like to have them delivered directly to your email or to your phone, you can manage or sign up either one, your subscription to our newsletter. Now, if you're signing up for the first time, it will ask you for a cell phone number. You can voluntarily give it to us, and we will send you a text that morning, usually on USDA report days, about the only time we'll send you a text, and it will have the numbers from the WASDE reports or whatever happens to be coming out from the United States Department of Agriculture. If you are already signed up for our weekend newsletter, go back to willag.org on the right-hand side and hit manage your subscription, and you'll be able to put your cell phone number in, and then you, too, will get a text, along with the email on the weekend that provides you with all that great information. It's part of the Agricultural Service from Illinois Public Media. This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked with Colleen Callahan. She's the State Director for USDA Rural Development in the state of Illinois. There was one item that we didn't take up in that conversation, and she really wanted to discuss. I thought we'd continue on our mission and hers today.
Oh, great. Well, you know, what we didn't talk about is really this is right down the wheelhouse here is the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food mission of this administration, which, again, as you know, is the marriage of bringing local production together with local consumption. And we have probably 15 different program opportunities between our business programs and our community programs. Let's just say a school wants to add a salad bar. We've got funding for that.
Really?
Yes. Yes. So when we talk about Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, that is an effort, as someone recently said, not everybody may need an attorney and not everybody may need an accountant, but everybody needs a farmer. And we want to know where our food comes from. And so the United States Department of Agriculture has come to the fore of that to do what it can to bring local production to local consumption through our Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food program. So if it's a farmer's market, if you need a pavilion, if you need whatever you need for that farmer's market, those are the kinds of programs that rural development can assist in. We didn't mention the value-added producer grant, and the most famous one in Illinois may be the Rock Jersey Cheese. And so for that entity in McLean County, when they were selling their Jersey milk that, you know, has the high fat content, but they were still getting whatever the market paid for it, they came to us and said, could you assist us in helping us add value to our product? We'd like to do a feasibility study and then ultimately, you know, get some equipment and actually do this processing on the farm. And to fast forward to now that Rock Jersey Cheese has its own brand and they distribute it throughout Illinois and even other states, they've become a little bit more of a master of their own ship, so to speak, and that was possible through a USDA Rural Development Value-Added Producer Grant.
Hmm. Can you take me back to the salad bar? So if I'm a community, it intrigues me.
I'm glad.
If I'm a community and a school in this community and I'd like to have a salad bar more affordably, I suppose, or just to have one, what does rural development do for that community? How does it manage to put a salad bar into a school? And where do you get the goods from?
Where do you get the...
the produce.
Well, that would not be something that USDA Rural Development would necessarily do. It would be providing the product. But let's say the school cafeteria, we would be able to provide funding for the equipment, the renovations, and the central processing or the distribution center for that. I mentioned the farmer's market, new construction, building purchase, renovations of an existing one. Community gardens. Let's say there is a community that wants to start a community garden. We can help with the real estate purchase, the infrastructure to connect water, to provide the irrigation that will be needed. Community kitchens. We can assist in funding for renovations to owned facilities, equipment used primarily for the community kitchen, or even a new construction. Now, community kitchens include those that provide classes on the preparation of healthy meals or prepare meals for community programs. Those are the kinds of things that in our community projects area, and that's the 20,000 under population, where we have funding available. Food banks, if you want to start a food bank, we can help with the building purchase, or if there's an existing facility, renovations, or new construction, as I mentioned, equipment, vehicles for the food delivery.
You mean food pantries?
Again.
As opposed to bank?
For a food bank.
For a food bank as opposed to a pantry, or for both?
Well, I don't know the definition. the distinction necessarily between
the food bank is the, because I work with these.
Is the housing.
Is the storage facility, sure. And the food pantry is usually the distribution point.
Is the That's right. And so really either food banks and food pantries would qualify, I believe. Certainly the food bank does. I don't think anybody's ever asked me the distinction between the two, if each would qualify. But it seems to me under the definition of what we're able to do for the financing that each would qualify. And if it didn't in community projects, then under the business program area, we talked about the value-added producer grant. Then we also have what is called the small socially disadvantaged producer grant, and that is for cooperatives and associations of cooperatives, and we can provide some technical assistance there. We also have the rural cooperative development grants. Those are for nonprofits, higher education, establish an operation to assist maybe with a business startup, expansion of improvement of some rural businesses, especially a co-op. And then we already talked about this intermediary relending program where the public bodies or not-for-profits can set up that revolving loan fund. We talked about the business and industry guaranteed loans, such as with RMH Foods. One of the things we did not touch on, though, Todd, is the REAP program, which is the Rural Energy for America program. That means the purchase and installation of renewable energy systems and energy efficiency improvements. Now, the highest percentage of those have been for grain dryers, but we also, this past year, had three of those loan and grant combination. One was for a greenhouse where they were able to make an older area of their greenhouse more energy efficient just by putting in one of those curtains. Another one was for a methane digester on a dairy. And another was for another large greenhouse facility where they were putting in a biomass unit for their heating purposes. So those are all examples of different programs, and I know we started off talking about Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, but in some way we are able to assist to that end. And an example in Freeport, Todd, is where the community worked together with the Extension Service, and they had identified a building in sort of a brownout area that they hoped to refurbish. And what they're doing with the grant that fits into the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food program is that the two entities are working together to create this community kitchen so that the equipment will be in there. And as many of us have had an unfortunate experience where we're really good at making a jelly or a jam, and so we do that in our kitchen, and then we take it to the farmer's market, and then someone with authority will say, you know, you can't sell that here because it wasn't produced in an approved health department inspected facility. Well, what the Freeport project will do ultimately when it's completed is create that community kitchen so that the produce can be brought in. It can be canned or processed and labeled and then can be sold at that farmer's market or whatever the retail outlet is because it was processed in an approved kitchen and then the individual didn't have their own personal expense in creating that same kind of setting in their home or at another location.
We would be amiss if we did not discuss how it is that people apply for the grants and the loans. Where do they go?
We have 12 offices throughout Illinois. There are 13 total. The state office is located in Champaign, not far from the Country Fair Shopping Center. There are two USDA buildings there, and Rural Development is sharing that location with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. There is also one of our area offices located in Champaign, and then we have in that area Effingham as well as Pontiac. And then you get further north, and we have Princeton and Oregon and Ottawa. And then you come around the horn a little bit, and then we're talking Galesburg and Jacksonville and Quincy. And then in the more southern part of the state, we have Edwardsville and Mount Vernon as well as Marion. So there are 125 employees throughout Illinois that are devoted to administering the rural development programs as they relate to lending and the needs that exist throughout rural Illinois. You can go to the USDA website, and you can just go to USDA Rural Development. That'll get you there. You can put USDA Rural Development, Illinois. That will get you there very specifically. But it's www.rurdev.usda.gov, and then a backslash, and IL. But again, Google it, USDA Rural Development, and it'll pop up.
Thank you again so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. If you have any other questions, and I hope you do, I hope you'll call again.
Absolutely, we will.
All right. Thanks, Todd.
That's Colleen Callahan. She is the State Director for USDA Rural Development in Illinois. We recorded that program a bit earlier in the year. By the way, if you have questions or comments or subjects you'd like covered on the farming world, we're always open to that. You can give Dave Dickey or myself a call. The number is 217-333-1070. That's 217-333-1070. And ask for either Dave Dickey or myself, Todd Gleason, or you can email both of us at the same time. It's just one email address, and it goes to the two of us. It's willagstaff@illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu. This is The Farming World. It is, of course, a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's National Donut Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1848, Franklin Hiram King was born, an American agricultural scientist. He was the inventor of the cylindrical tower silo. He also invented a gravity system of ventilation for dairy barns that was widely used until electric-powered blowers became commonly available. King was a giant in agriculture. He also studied soil physics, including water holding capacities, moisture requirements of plants, aeration, movement of water in soils, and soil fertility. He also conducted the first year-long study of power generated by farm windmills. In 1859, Walter Hunt died. Hunt invented the first safety pin in 1849. It was made out of a piece of brass wire about 8 inches long, coiled at the center and shielded at one end. In 1908, the UN National Conservation Commission was formed by President Theodore Roosevelt. The commission prepared the first inventory of the natural resources of the U.S., including water, forests, lands, and minerals. And in 1992, the UN Environmental Agency was formed and adopted a 300-page plan for achieving sustainable development in the 21st century. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is The Farming World. I'm Todd Gleason. Late last week, I discussed foliar fungicide applications on corn with University of Illinois Extension plant pathologist Carl Bradley. He says corn farmers are coming under unusual pressure to put fungicides on earlier than ever this year, but the data suggest it's not really worthwhile.
There's some activity out in the fields going on right now where people are spraying herbicides, and of course that's Aaron's part of this, but some of them are tank mixing fungicides along with the herbicides, and that's really what we want to talk about today. And of course I'll be talking about if you need to or don't need to spray a fungicide this early, and what are some of the things to think about as far as applying a fungicide in general to your corn crop.
So the first question is, should you, can you, would you spray a fungicide this early in the season?
I think, well, the part of the problem, Todd, is that there's not a whole lot of data out there right now where people have really evaluated foliar fungicide applications to corn at, say, V6 stage, which is pretty small. The little bit of data that has been compiled really has not shown a clear benefit to doing it. And if one were to apply a fungicide, I think it might be best to wait till later on, maybe around tassel emergence or when the crop is silking. And you may see a bigger benefit then, because that's really when the diseases are around.
So are there curative actions? So I know I'm going to talk to him. Are there curative actions in the fungicides? Does it last until we get to tasseling at this point? And would it help if you put it on now, or does it really need to be applied when the disease is present at that particular time?
The fungicides will give some protection for about 2 to 3 weeks, and so that would not carry all the way into tasseling. As far as curative activity, some of them have a little bit of curative activity, but really they work best when they're applied preventatively. But in a corn crop, you're really mostly worried about the leaf that's closest to the ear and right around the ear. And so you can get away with some disease on the lower leaves, but really watching the disease and sometime around just prior to tassel emergence, going out and scouting and looking to see where that disease is as far as how high up it is, and then applying a fungicide if needed. If conditions are really favorable for disease, if you are seeing some diseases out there in the lower leaves, it's good to know a little bit about your hybrid, how susceptible it is to some of the common foliar diseases. We've got a pretty wide range of hybrids that are available, and along with that, some of them are very susceptible, and some of them have some good resistance levels. Another thing to consider is what the previous crop was. If you have corn on corn, most of your diseases, the pathogens that cause disease, will be overwintering in that corn stubble, and so you have it right there in the field, then the risk for disease is a little higher. So those are some of the things to think about when you're making the decision on if you need to apply a fungicide or not.
When the producer goes to the field at this stage, V6, a little bigger maybe, are they going to find a disease there, and is that a problem?
About the only thing present right now, if you go out and walk some fields, is anthracnose leaf blight. And at this stage, you're only going to find it on the lower leaves. In fact, this morning I walked out to some of my research plots here close to campus, and I could find some anthracnose on the lower leaves where I have corn on corn, where there's a lot of corn residue on the soil surface, and that's just because it's been wet, and so the rain splashes the spores from the debris onto those lower leaves. At this stage in time, anthracnose leaf blight is not going to be a problem. Some producers get a little worried about anthracnose stalk rot, which is caused by the same organism, but those infections that cause stalk rot really, we don't think, occur from those leaf blight stage. It occurs from infections down in the root very early in the season. So applying a fungicide now is probably not going to do too much for helping protect against anthracnose stalk rot later on in the season.
Of course, one of the reasons the producers put a foliar fungicide on is because they believe that there may be a yield bump. You've done some work with that. You talked just a little bit earlier about the limited amount of data that's available at this point on early foliar fungicide application. Can you tell me about the yield bump in both cases?
Well, from the data that from the results of the trials that we've conducted here in Illinois, and when you look regionally as well and look at other universities and extension services that have done some of the research, we see that the yield bump is generally there when you're controlling a disease. So if you're going to see a yield bump, it's most likely due, it's not really a yield bump, it's yield protection. It's from controlling a disease. On rare occasions, we can sometimes find some type of a yield bump when we can't really relate it to disease control. So that can happen, but that, in our data, that happens at a very low frequency. And really, if you're going to see a yield benefit with these fungicides, we really feel like it comes from controlling a disease.
Finally, Carl, is it okay if producers just call you directly?
Yes, yeah, that's fine. Producers can call or email me directly. Email sometimes works the best. I can catch email no matter where I am, and it's easier to get back to people that way.
And your contact information is?
Email address is carlbrad, C-A-R-L-B-R-A-D, at illinois.edu. And phone number is 217-244-7415.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Carl Bradley. He's an extension plant pathologist at the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support comes from the Westchester Group in Champaign, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in the acquisition, management, and disposition of agricultural investments for institutional, corporate, and individual clients. Information at 800-607-6888 or at westchester-group.com.